to carry on. And if I could, I surely would go back and change the past. But wishing doesn't do any good when time rolls by so fast. I traded in my youth for these prison blues. I guess it was my first.
Welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Grace Wan. That music that we heard was a song called Trying to Carry On by a San Quentin prison band called Quentin Blue. It was written by Richie Morris and performed by Morris, Dwight Crisman, and Charlie Spencer. Life in San Quentin State Prison is the focus of our program tonight, and I'm excited to introduce our two guests who have a unique window and perspective on life there. First, we have Nigel Poor, the co-host and co-producer of Ear Hustle, a podcast that features prisoners sharing their experience of prison life. Nigel is also a visual artist and professor of photography. Welcome, Nigel.
Thank you.
Our second guest is Jody Lewin, the founder and executive director of the Prison University Project at San Quentin. The project provides prisoners access to higher education and was founded over 20 years ago. In 2016, it was awarded the National Humanities Medal from President Obama for its work. Welcome.
Thank you.
The programs that Nigel and Jody are involved in are part of the relatively robust selection of offerings available to San Quentin inmates. San Quentin is a minimum security state prison for roughly 3,000 inmates who reside there, and it has fewer violent incidents than other state prisons. For all of these reasons, despite being overcrowded at over 122% capacity, many California prisoners request to be transferred there. Tonight, we will ask Nigel and Jody for their thoughts about redemption, the ability of these prisoners to become productive citizens. We'll ask them what they've learned about human nature and basic human needs, for something to nurture, for personal connection, for what makes us human. And we'll ask them what happens when those basic needs are taken away. In short, what do they know that we don't that would allow us to think differently about the criminal justice system? And in 20 minutes, we will invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 1-866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. Do you have questions or comments about San Quentin and its inmates? Have you had a personal experience related to San Quentin? We want to hear from you. So, ladies, welcome to the program tonight. I'm excited to be able to talk about your work there. I wanted to start out by telling our listeners a little bit about what San Quentin is like. And maybe, Nigel, can you describe where it is, who's there, and what it's like when you enter the prison?
Sure, I can talk about it from my experience. So San Quentin is located in the Bay Area. It's right over the Golden Gate Bridge. It's in an oddly beautiful setting, which makes it a strange experience. When you walk in, you're obviously walking into a prison. You walk through a few security gates, and then you come into this really beautiful garden area that's well maintained by the men who are in there. So you get the first impression that people are trying to make this a home, a place where they are, whether they want to be there or not. You walk down into the yard, and when you get there, you see sometimes hundreds of men working out, talking, hanging out. You see Mount Tam behind you. And then I walk through there, and it's like walking into a village. People are really friendly. They look you in the eye. They ask how you're doing. I've been going in there for a few years now, so I know a lot of people. So I often stop and chat on the way in there, and I always feel very welcomed and excited to start my work day in there.
Yeah, I think people might be surprised that where San Quentin is located in Marin County, mm-hmm. It is on the bay, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Jody, can you tell me about the inmate population? Who is there? I think a lot of people think of San Quentin as a place where death row inmates are, but I think it's more than that.
Yeah. So by way of background, when you're sentenced to state prison in California, you first go to classification and you're assigned a certain number of points based on your commitment offense, gang affiliations, family ties, other things that the department considers predictors of violence. though that others wouldn't necessarily consider that. But the point level, the points that you are assigned then through classification determine what security level institution you'll be housed in. So if somebody comes in for a serious violent crime, they would have, say, more points and be at a higher security level institution. But you go back to classification each year if you're not written up for disciplinary fractions or whatever, you don't commit any new crimes while you're in prison, then the points will drop over time. And as your points drop, you're eligible to be housed at a lower security level institution. So at San Quentin, the general population, the vast majority of people incarcerated there are level two or medium security prison. So all you really know about a level two population is that their points are below a certain, I guess it's 27 now, I'm not exactly sure, but that their points are below a certain level so they can be housed there. And so the people in terms of their commitment offenses are extremely diverse. But if they came in for serious crime, they've not had serious problems with the institution for many, many years. And then death row is also there. Those men are also incarcerated. There are over 700 people on death row who are at San Quentin. But they are not allowed to program with the rest of the population, so they're kept separate.
And Jody, tell us a little bit about the Prison University Project. What does it do for prisoners, and what do you do for the project?
Yeah. So I am the executive director, and the program that we offer provides college preparatory courses in math and English, and as well as general ed associate courses in liberal arts leading to an associate's degree. And so the sole requirement is that students have to have a GED or a high school diploma to enroll. But there are no fees or tuition. We don't screen people based on age, length of sentence, commitment offense, time left to serve. Anybody who's level two program eligible can get on the wait list. And then most folks will spend about a year in the college prep program on average before they go into the credit classes. So it can take anywhere between 3 and 5 years to complete the AA, depending on what else they're doing, how many classes they take at a time. But our goal is to provide a high-quality higher education, an associate's degree that not only helps them not only is the degree itself, but also prepares them to transfer to complete a BA or higher after they parole.
And so they would complete their education after they leave prison to get a bachelor's degree.
Exactly, exactly.
And what kind of areas are they studying? What kind of subjects?
Well, the associate's degree that we offer is a general ed AA. So there are 20 classes required for the degree, and they are introductory courses in, you know, across the spectrum, the humanities, social science, math, science. So philosophy, history, psychology, sociology, government, literature, and then also math through college algebra, statistics, pre-calc, and then a whole variety of science classes that they can
So very take. Extensive.
Yeah.
And so back to you, Nigel. Tell us a little bit about Ear Hustle. What is it? I mean, I think some of our listeners may be familiar with it, but for those who don't know.
Right. So Ear Hustle is a podcast project that's done inside of the prison. And I always want to make clear that it's not a crime podcast. It's a podcast about everyday life in prison and what happens to you once you become incarcerated. So all of the work is done inside, all of the interviewing, all of the editing, the sound design, everything is done by myself and men that are incarcerated at San Quentin. Now, we do have outside people helping us, so I want to make that clear. We have someone that helps us with music, Pat Macedi Miller from Snap Judgment, and we work very closely with Julie Shapiro from Radiotopia, but ostensibly everything is done inside the prison.
And you have two co-producers. You want to tell us a little bit about them?
So Erlon Woods is a co-host and co-producer, and we do most of the interviewing and the editing. We co-host, and we kind of conceive of the stories and the arc of the season. And then Antoine Williams helps us with the sound design and the music.
And what does Ear Hustle mean?
Well, I had heard the word quite a few years ago, probably about 12 years ago, from a friend of mine who was working in a prison, and it means eavesdropping. And I'm a born eavesdropper. I love to know what everyone's up to. I always find it fascinating to hear people's stories. And so when we talked about doing a podcast, I said to Erlon, I think Ear Hustle is the perfect name. And he just cracked up that I knew the expression. but I think it's perfect because it references prison. It also references what we're doing, which is listening to the quiet things, the small things that people might overlook. And our stories are intentionally not salacious or dramatic. Again, they really are about the everyday, the quiet things, the humble things, the things that people may not realize hold a lot of meaning. But once you start asking questions and listening carefully, this beautiful world unfolds to you.
And why is that your area of interest? Why are you looking at that versus other aspects of the prison?
Well, I'm an artist, and for as long as I can remember, I've been interested in how people find meaning, how we become productive, how do we understand the time that we have that's pretty short on this earth, and how do we make an impression, and how do we decide what's worthy of being documented. And so I just took that interest and brought it in to San Quentin with me, and it just seemed like a potent way to talk about who's inside prison, why they're there, again, how do you make a life. There's plenty of other people who can do stories about statistics and about, you know, how do we change policy. I don't think that way, and I think it's really important when you to do something well to find where your heart is with it and where you can deeply engage, and that's where I can engage, is with storytelling and with listening.
And how did you find your co-producers? Did they find you, or did you find them?
Well, I also do want to say I started in the prison through the Prison University Project. That's my connection, and I'm very grateful for Jody. She's really taught me a lot, and I think gave me a good, solid footing to go in there, because it can be a very complicated place to work. So I taught with the Prison University Project for 3 semesters, and through that, I met a bunch of really interesting men and started working with a group of guys starting a radio show. And I did that for about 3 years. And that's where I met Erlon and Antoine. And Erlon was a super quiet guy, but I could tell he was a really good observer. And I like quiet people. I like the people that don't tell you everything about themselves at the beginning. And so when I started thinking about a podcast, he just seemed like the natural fit. And so we started talking about it, and we just gelled. I mean, I just found a really good working professional partner in him. And then we brought in Antoine because we knew he was really into music. So that's how it started. And I think a lot of people thought Erlon could never do this because he's too quiet, but he's not. He's a gem.
Quiet but mighty.
Yes.
So Nigel was talking about how San Quentin can be a complicated place to work, Jody. How have you found it as a place to work with inmates and within that system?
Well, so I would say, relatively speaking, contrary to sort of popular belief, that the student population is not your greatest challenge, right? I mean, there are certainly quirky people there like there are on any college campus, but it's much more the bureaucracy. I think the really complex institutional culture, and then the incredibly broad range of attitudes and feelings that people have towards folks who are coming in to do something positive in this type of environment. And, you know, and also the reality is that the prison is not designed as an institution to help people, right? It's designed to sort of run. It's sort of like a, you know, everybody's got to get up in the morning. Everybody's got to be fed. Everybody's got to get to work. Everybody's got to be counted. You know, that's what it's designed for, is to sort of maintain those institutional rituals. And so it's almost like, it's like, what's that jump rope thing, like double Dutch in hell, where you're sort of trying to sort of fit in, you know, somehow and not get knocked over, or maybe like standing on a log in water. It's something between those two things. But so it's just, you know, it's not there for you. And so you have to kind of work around it. But in addition, I mean, there are other aspects, like I think a lot of folks, Nigel and I have talked a lot about this, but a lot of folks come into the prison for very complicated reasons that I think, frankly, they often don't themselves fully understand. And so, you know, when you work inside, particularly when you're running a program, you're not just volunteers or, you know, other folks, journalists, you know, everybody who wants to come in has some sort of, often it seems like a psychological in addition to perhaps a political agenda. And so you have to really become, I think, an observer and a kind of critic in terms of understanding whether folks are able to come in and really serve the people who are going to be impacted and who are supposed to be served, rather than serving themselves in some way, however benign and intentioned. And I think at times that can just be very complex work.
Mm-hmm. And as a student of the project, what are classes like? How often are they held? Where are they held? And who teaches them?
So there's an education area. It's actually three very small buildings fenced off right on the lower yard. And so it's spatially quite integrated into the prison. The classes themselves generally meet twice a week for a couple of hours. And the instructors are mostly faculty or grad students from the local Bay Area colleges and universities. So Stanford, Berkeley, USF, UC Davis, all these different schools that folks are coming from. And the classes, I think, are in many respects quite similar to any other college campus environment. The differences are the students are all men, except for a couple of transgender students who we have in the program. And they're all, wearing the same outfit, but whatever. And I guess the major difference is that they're much more diverse in terms of age, really in every way, than a conventional college campus. And I taught as a grad student at Berkeley for many years. And if I had two or three black students in my class, I noticed it because it was unusual. And probably 50% of our students are black. And then, a variety of other races and ethnicities, that's different. And they're adults, they have much more life experience. Everybody wants to be there. No one is there because their peers went or their parents wanted them or forced them to go. Everybody is highly motivated and deeply grateful for the opportunity to be in school.
Are they lecture classes or is it a discussion group? And
so we generally try not to have more than 22 or 25 students in a class. It depends if the demand is really great, but they tend to be much more discussion based. So we don't have, those lecture classes where you have 150 people there and it's just the professor talking. Our teachers also just tend to be more interactive, I think. Mm-hmm.
And who funds the program?
So there's no state or federal funding at all. It's entirely funded by foundations and individuals. And it really runs the gamut. There are several large foundations that are funding our work, but also a lot of individuals and sort of small and medium family foundations as well. They've actually been the backbone
of the program.
Yeah.
And how did you get involved, Nigel? Just as a volunteer? Or?
Yeah. So I had been thinking about prisons for a while, and I wanted to go into one, but I didn't want to go in as just an observer. I wanted to go in with a purpose. And I heard about the Prison University Project, and I think I answered some kind of ad for it. They were looking for somebody to teach an art history class. So that's how I started. And you ask about what the classes are like. I teach at California State University, Sacramento. And I teach a history of photography class there. And I did my best to completely replicate that class inside the prison. I didn't change it. I didn't make it easier. I didn't make it harder. And I had to be very careful when I went back to my university to not compare my university students to the students inside, because the guys inside, I hate to say it, worked so much harder. Mm-hmm. They were just great students. They were so engaged. They were so ready for conversation. And it really kind of renewed my excitement about teaching. It's a great experience to teach in there.
I think it's interesting that here's prison where you might not want to be, but here's a class where you really want to be.
Yeah.
And that kind of the reflection that people have about that. What are some of the challenges of working with an inmate population?
I wanted to go back to one thing that you said about the classroom. I think the reason that guys get so engaged, it's because everybody wants to be challenged. Everyone wants their brain to be working at full capacity. And one of the things about prison that I find most distressing is that people can lay fallow there and become a wasted resource. I'm not calling people a resource, but everyone has potential, and when nobody is challenging your potential, you atrophy. And so it's like giving someone water. It's so essential to life, and people come alive when they have a challenge. So,
yeah, right. And so you have very motivated students who are grateful for an opportunity, it seems, to challenge themselves.
Right.
And you were reflecting a little bit, Nigel, that maybe the prison population that you work with is more motivated in class. What are some of the challenges of working with an inmate population that you've seen?
Well, one thing I would say is that there's institutional challenges, and Jody touched on that. There can be lockdowns for reasons, so students can miss class. To me, that was the biggest with institutional challenges. I never had a problem with a student, but I think one time when I was teaching, there was a lockdown for a week. So you have a lesson plan. You have to always be flexible in prison. So that's always my challenge, is like you go in with a plan, but you've got to be ready to pivot to meet those kinds of incidents that are, you just can't predict them.
Yeah, you're not going to experience that outside of prison. I want to return to that, but first let me say that this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Nigel Poor, the co-host and co-producer of the acclaimed podcast Ear Hustle, which is recorded at San Quentin, and also Jody Lewin, the founder and executive director of the Prison University Project at San Quentin. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. If you've listened to Ear Hustle, let us know what you thought. This is your opportunity to ask Nigel and Jody your questions about prisoners and prison life. The number to call to join our conversation is 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So we're talking about some of the challenges before the break. And Jody, what do you see as challenges?
You know, it's interesting. Certainly the issues that Nigel just mentioned, but I would mention as well, I mean, I think what teachers often experience, for example, that most of our students have not had a conventional academic trajectory. Right? We have students who taught themselves to read or learned to read or write as adults after they got to prison. So their academic skill level and just background and orientation is much more diverse than in a conventional classroom, where particularly where students have completed high school and, you know, really gotten the basics by the time they were 18 or so. And so I think for instructors, it's often challenging to have students with a very diverse range of skill levels and perspectives. But a lot of the time, the things that are challenging are also what make it really rewarding, you know, and also in particular because students, I think by and large, have had overwhelmingly negative experiences while they were in school. And so they also come in often in the very beginning quite wary. And often reluctant to ask for help or to show, you know, vulnerability of any kind. And what I've observed is that generally over time, when students have the opportunity to get to know the teachers and sort of see what they're about and, you know, get comfortable with their, you know, level of competence and their intentions, you know, their goodwill and all that, that eases and students certainly open up. But what's challenging is that they don't come in automatically trusting the teacher, right? Or they don't even come in trusting the program. They're curious, they're hopeful, but it's not a given. Trust is not the default mode of anybody in prison. And so the challenge, I think, is simply to be patient, to not take that personally, and to just be consistent and stick with it. And then I think, you know, trust grows over time, and then, you know, you see students more willing to sort of share their vulnerability, to allow others to help them. And, you know, so a lot of those things that were challenging, you know, really pay off mm-hmm. for everybody.
Well, one of the things that is illuminating about your work is that you guys are focused on kind of rehabilitation and redemption, that aspect of prison life. And I think people are more familiar with the punishment aspect of it. And you were mentioning, Nigel, about how being in prison, sometimes you lie fallow. And I wanted to play a clip from Ear Hustle. It's about solitary confinement. Armando Flores served 26 years in solitary confinement. I'd like to listen to him talk about the impact of that extended isolation.
Being in the SHU for so long, it will affect you in many ways. You know, a lot of times in the SHU, we talk about the SHU syndrome. You know, from not being able to finish a sentence to forgetting what you're talking about during a sentence. Sometimes you can't even carry a full conversation with somebody.
Being locked up in.
So that's Armando Flores, who has served 26 years in solitary confinement. Nigel, can you explain to our audience what the SHU is?
The SHU is the segregated housing unit, and it's this particular one is in Pelican Bay, and I believe it's actually closed now, but it was where, at least in Armando's situation, where men were sent that had gang affiliation. And they were sent there for indeterminate terms until, and I'm hoping I get this right, until they gave information that was requested. But Armando never did that, so he was there for a very long period of time. The rules have changed around that, and I can't speak in detail to it, but he was there for the longest of anyone that we interviewed. And with our stories, we don't talk too much about policy. We let the story tell itself, and you can hear in his voice, you know, how damaged he was by this experience and his difficulty with language. It tells a very crushing story.
Well, when he was in solitary, he didn't have very much human contact for hours and hours a day. Kind of talk a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, well, and again, in California, it's called the segregated housing unit. Men can be housed with a cellie, but he was alone most of the time in his cell. I believe they get out for an hour every day. But the cells are set up in such a way that you can't really see other people. You can obviously see people when they walk by. You can yell to people, but there isn't a lot of human contact. And, you know, people really atrophy there and have deeply, you know, troubling psychological implications for going through that.
And if you listen to that podcast, you can hear that Armando actually has trouble putting sentences together, and maybe that is in result of spending so much time alone.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The Ear Hustle does an interesting job of kind of illuminating what day-to-day life is like in a prison. And I think in the media and often in TV shows, we have one sense of what that could be like. But I wanted to play another clip about having a compatible cellmate. It's an episode called Cellies. And let's listen to the clip of cellmates who got along really well. This is Shaw Wallace, Scepter, and Dante Smith. All right, we're waiting for the clip. And all right, so I guess that clip isn't coming up. That happens on public radio. But can you tell us a little bit about the importance of having a good cellmate? And how big is your cell?
The cells are 5 by 10 feet. So you can reach your left and right arm out and touch both walls. You lay down the bed and there's just a few feet behind you. There's a bunk bed, two men in there with a toilet and a sink and a shelf. There's two gates that go over it. There's the bars that you imagine. And there's also like a mesh gate that goes over it. So when it's closed, it's extraordinarily claustrophobic, and you better get along with the person that you're living with. And we that was actually our first story of season one, and we wanted to do a story that people on the outside could relate to, because everyone has had the experience of trying to find somebody to live with and be compatible with. In prison, it's extreme because your home is so tiny.
Yeah. I think we have the clip. So let's hear them talking about that.
Ricky from Boys in the Hood. I don't even know the name of that movie.
What was that? What do you call part two?
That had Gabrielle Union in it.
Nah, I know I said I don't like talkers, but Dante and Shy, they are cellies, and they're chopping it up in the way that is totally compatible, totally acceptable. That kind of talking wouldn't bother me.
Yeah, they came down here yesterday and started talking, and we had to pull out the recorder. I mean, I just imagine that's what they're like all the time in their cell.
Yeah, every night they have their top five. Who's the best black actors? Who's the best basketball players? Who's the best rappers?
Top five, right? Jay-Z and Ja Rule in the same category.
Come on, bro.
Blueprint 2 ain't blood in my eyes. Part 2.
And what we heard there was you, Nigel, and also Erlon, right?
Yeah.
That's your co-producer.
Yeah.
How does he it sounds like those two get along very well.
Yes.
And is that the norm or is that unusual?
Well, I think, you know, it's just like on the outside. Some people find a good person to live with and some people don't. But they happen to, you know, find each other, and they got along really well. And, you know, they're young guys and they want to have fun, and then they do that.
How does having a co-producer who lives on the inside help you find stories? Are you finding the stories together, or is he kind of identifying them for you? Or
No, we do everything together, and it was really important with this project that we wanted an outside and an inside voice. So Erlon's the expert inside. He helps guide the stories. He's the person I go to with questions. I guess I represent the outside. I'm not an expert on the outside world, but I bring in those questions, and we're able to talk it through, and he can help me dispel some of my myths and assumptions, and I can push him to answer things that he maybe hadn't thought of or maybe doesn't really want to answer. So we have a very good back and forth between us.
Yeah. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about why is Erlon in prison? What brought him there?
Oh, he's a three striker. He's serving 31 years to life for attempted robbery.
Some of our listeners might not be familiar with three strikes. Jody, do you want to tell us a little bit about how that works and what it is?
Yeah, well, it varies somewhat state to state, but I'm also not a sentencing law expert, but my understanding is that in California and in other states as well, if someone had, for example, if someone had two prior felonies or even a felony and a misdemeanor, I think it was also, if they received another felony, they could receive a life sentence. So even if if they received another misdemeanor, then as a third strike, then the misdemeanor could be charged as a felony. I mean, I don't know all the details, but the point is that a crime that one would otherwise have not been sentenced to life for, one could be sentenced to life for. So the premise was, I don't know, somehow for some reason in criminal justice policy, people think if it rhymes, it must have some logic or sanity to it. But I don't know where people got that idea. But so the point is that if they've, three strikes and you're out, or if it, I don't know, resonates with something you heard in childhood, it must have some. But so what it produced was just this vast array of people with these, what in any sort of rational context would have been perceived as and is perceived as disproportionate sentences. Just all these people who got huge amounts of time for relatively minor offenses. And recently, in the last several years, there have been a number of different laws that have passed or propositions that have passed that that have overturned that and have allowed people who were sentenced under three strikes to have their sentences reviewed. But it actually, there were certain limitations on who that applied to. So there are still folks inside who were sentenced under three strikes and are still doing life terms.
And how does that affect students who are in your program? If they have a life sentence, are those the kind of inmates who would be in your program?
Yeah, and we feel really strongly about building a program that is as inclusive as humanly possible. So like I said earlier, we don't care what you're in for and how long you're going to be there for. And the thing, I mean, in a sense, this gets at kind of a larger issue, which I feel like we're also always grappling with, which is how when we think about incarcerated people, we tend, particularly as a society, and when we think about policy and programs and program access, we tend to think in terms of, well, what's in it for me, right, as an outsider, as a member of, like, so-called society, well, how will that affect me? And so what's interesting is, like, I always say to people, when some folks say, well, why would you educate someone who's not going to leave anytime soon? And I just say to people, my mother's never going to leave New York. what possible relevance does that have, right? But what you realize, what's interesting to me is when people talk about, well, why would you educate somebody who might not be leaving anytime soon, that it's not only that we tend to think about the well-being of prisoners solely in terms of the impact on everyone else rather than on them, thinking about their lives actually mattering, but we also seem to think of prison as somehow not in the world. Like, people talk about going back out into society. Like, we have this sort of collective fantasy that prisons and prisoners are not fully in the world. And so, and then there's a moral kind of corollary to that, which is that somehow they also don't matter the way everybody else matters, or that they're that the harm that's done to them doesn't count in the same way in a moral sense that the harm done to others would count. And so I kind of feel like one of the many things that I value deeply about Nigel's work and Erlon and Antoine's work and everybody else who works with them, but also the work going on inside our program and the contact that our students have with teachers and other folks on the outside, is that it calls all of that into question. That you're reminded that the prison is a place. It's just, in a sense, another ordinary place, in a spatial sense. And I sort of feel like the work of changing the whole system is really, at the end of the day, really about changing the way that everybody imagines prison and the people who are inside.
There's just been such a strong movement to think about rehabilitation and redemption and a life after prison, and that's kind of what your program is doing.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, we see this a lot with funders. They'll say, or some huge funding initiatives lately where, you know, there's more attention being focused on prisons and reentry, but they'll want to focus resources on people who have 5 years or less to serve, for example. That's really, or 2 years or less to serve. And the assumption is, I think, first of all, well, you're not really using education if you're, you know, they have a very sort of vocational, utilitarian idea of education and what its value is. But it's also just, again, they don't seem to really fully matter, you know. But the other thing I was just going to say is that I think very often when we think about programs as rehabilitative, part of the struggle I have with that is that I think, you know, the rehabilitation, in a sense, is kind of a secular redemption sort of concept, right? We sort of think of it as, the way we imagine is that the prisoner is sort of broken and bad somehow, and then the program comes and makes them good, right? It fixes them, it repairs them in some fundamental way. And what's interesting to me is that there are certainly a lot of people inside who feel that their lives have been transformed and that they have been healed or helped in some very profound way. And I appreciate that. I recognize that. But I also think to some extent that that narrative also serves to sort of reinforce the legitimacy of the practice of incarceration, right? Because what it does is it reassures us, well, he was bad. He belonged in prison. And it also presents not just the program, but the prison as somehow legitimate or validating, right? Or validated, you know, it really sort of says, okay, well, he needed to be in prison, but then we fixed him, and so now he can be safely released. And the reality is that the individuals who are incarcerated are not simply bad and broken, right? And a lot of, I think people tend to assume also that we're educating people and fixing them also intellectually and academically. We have students who didn't know how to read or write when they got to prison, but they were already brilliant. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so I guess those are my reservations about that kind of conceptual vocabulary, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it seems like you both are working to find the humanity in everyone who you come in contact with. And I think there's another clip that we have from Ear Hustle, which really sort of epitomizes that. And that's the experience of Roach, who is a prisoner who has made critter friends. He doesn't call them animals. He calls them critters. And I think let's take a listen to that. Roach is somebody who experienced no love or stability as a child. But in prison, he spent his time nurturing birds and bugs and a lot of other creatures. I'm actually surprised at how many he was able to find. Let's listen to an audio clip of Roach talking about the swallows he snuck into his cell and what happened to them.
So when I have to take care of another baby swallow, oh, it will happen again. I will keep it in my shirt pocket on my person so it can hear my heartbeat and my voice and feel connected or nurture. I take care of animals because they teach me what I can't learn from people. It's unconditional affection or appreciation. Unconditional love is here. No, it's yours, you know. No, nothing. No, it's all you.
It's a great story how he's able to take these swallows into his cell. He must have actually a very accommodating cellie, I'm guessing.
Sometimes, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about him.
So Roach, as you mentioned, grew up in a pretty difficult situation. By six, he was in different foster homes, and I'm not sure what age he was when he got to prison, but I think he's been in for close to 20 years. And what I really enjoy about him is his exploration to find love and give love. He says it's unconditional, but I'm not sure that's exactly what he's looking for. I think he is really trying to nurture and be nurtured. And he's so fascinated by living creatures. He always has something on him. Like recently, he found this sack of praying mantis eggs that he's been taking care of. And he told me when they hatch, they'll be as big as a fingernail clipping. So he's always out there. He's got this, you know, wild kingdom in the prison. And he's always putting love somewhere or receiving love. So I totally enjoy him. He's delightful most of the time. Sometimes he's a pain, but like anybody, right? I mean, he's not a saint, but yeah. he does love his critters.
Are they all in a cell or are they
No. Some of them are outside. Technically, you're not allowed to have pets, so sometimes correctional officers will throw them out, and that's upsetting to him. But he also has ones outside. And he just knows where they hang out, like where his lizards are and the different birds that he helps to take care of. A lot of birds, for some reason, in San Quentin get their feet tangled up in twine and stuff. So he's often out there detangling the feet of different birds.
Hmm. That's a great story. Let me just do a station break here. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Nigel Poor, the co-host and co-producer of the acclaimed podcast Ear Hustle, recorded at San Quentin, and also Jody Lewin, the founder and executive director of the Prison University Project at San Quentin. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call in or join our conversation is 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on the kalw.org or Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisions@kalw. So we have a comment from Margaret. I could listen to Erlon all day long. He has a great voice and a beautiful heart. Thank you for Ear Hustle. So you've got some fans out there.
That's very nice.
What are other programs at San Quentin that you admire that you would want to give some love and a shout out to? Jody?
Wow, there are a lot. I mean, the California Reentry Program provides individualized advising to people who are preparing for release. They're entirely volunteer-driven. And they are almost like a social service referral agency where they provide information and resources and connect people so that they have a plan for when they get out. You know, that, I think, is huge. The Inside Prison Project is an entire organization that runs a number of different programs inside. They do work in the realm of victim-offender education, dialogues, and other work of that type, which is also extraordinary. There's a GED tutoring program, which is amazing, called the Academic Peer Education Project. And, oh, my goodness, there are so many. I'm going to forget, like, all the other ones that I'm going to regret not mentioning on the air. But what's interesting is it really is a whole community of people and programs and organizations that are sort of working together to sort of create not just some semblance of normalcy, but really kind of almost a pipeline or a continuum of care and support. So there are also then, like, there's an organization called Return Citizen, which was working with people primarily when they get out of San Quentin, which is extraordinary, right? They're literally meeting people at the gate and helping them get acclimated. And what I find interesting is that really for programs to be effective, and this is true of all kind of programs probably in the world, the client or the student has to trust the provider, right? And so a lot of these programs, like Return Citizen, was actually created by a colleague named David Cowan, and who was also incarcerated himself. And his understanding of the needs and the experiences of the people he's serving is just unparalleled anyplace else. And I think that that's a really common thread in a lot of the programs that do really strong work inside, is that there are really strong bonds of trust and respect between the practitioners and the providers.
Is there anything that you would want to mention, Nigel?
Of course, it's hard. There are smaller groups. Artistic Ensemble is a group that's run by Amy Dowling that does dance. Well, I don't know if she would call it dance, but performance, and really encourages the men to be super creative. They do really wonderful performances. There's San Quentin Cooks, where guys are learning, you know, how to actually cook somewhat fancy meals, which I think is wonderful, and have a, you know, work towards having a job when they get out. Yeah.
Veterans Healing Veterans from the Inside Out, goodness, is working with incarcerated veterans.
Yeah.
It's incredible how many programs there are. And if you wanted to volunteer, for example, with Prison University Project, how would you go about doing that?
Well, all the programs we just mentioned, I think, have websites. So that's really the thing to do, is to get online and make contact through the site.
And with your program, Jody, do you need to be a teacher or a professor to participate in it?
The lead instructors have to have at least a master's degree in the field. Mm-hmm. We have tutors that have... and teaching assistants or occasionally co-instructors who have not yet completed the master's. But that's generally. Most of our lead instructors have the master's or a PhD.
Yeah. And do you have to write papers?
Yeah. So our program, you mean for the students?
Yes.
Is really, really writing intensive, you know, because we want our students to be not just as prepared but better prepared than anybody when they get out. And they have to be, and they know that. So we get a lot of really positive praise. We have a whole cohort of guys who were at San Francisco State. Shout out to Project Rebound, also at San Francisco State. And they are amazing and really thriving. And a lot of them really say, wow, you know, this is nothing compared to what we went through on the inside, yeah, you know, academically.
Yeah, funny. We have a call from Bill. Bill, are you there?
I am. How you doing?
Fine.
I love the guy with the voids. You know, there was a program on KALW that talked about Norway. And the big difference is that Norway, you know, you have lost your right to the rest of civil society, but you haven't lost your humanity. And their recidivism rate is significantly lower than ours. And ours is pretty high even compared to other English-speaking countries, mostly from the Commonwealth. And this country is really good at being destructive. And that's destructive of people and other things. And, you know, I appreciate the work that you're doing, you know, because we've got to get beyond seeing how much we can punish and how tough we can be, because really, as... my good friend, now I'm blanking on his name, said, Frederick Douglass, said, you know, it's easier to build strong boys than it is heal broken men. And, you know,
yeah,
just, I mean, some of it has to do with how we treat white collar crime versus black, excuse me for that Freudian slip, versus blue collar crime, mm-hmm. You know.
Well, Bill, I think you bring a good point of what is prison like and outside of the United States, and I think you get a lot of kind of fan mail, I think, Nigel, mm-hmm. from people around the world. And do you hear that often?
Yeah, and I want to say Ear Hustle gets fan mail. I don't get the fan mail.
Yes,
but yes, we do. We actually have. I don't know why we have a lot of listeners in actually Norway and Sweden, and that's often their comments about how different prison is in the United States. But yeah, we do hear from all around the world. Yeah,
Jody?
I was just also going to say, I think an important point that Bill just raised was also that our system is not about reason, right? It's not. It's really. It almost seems like it's just become an opportunity for the kind of collective to vent or dump its aggression and its hostility, sort of generalized hostility. It's sort of like we've just learned to convert fear and bitterness into a sadistic impulse and built an institution around it. But I think that is sort of the thing. It's not about reason. To me, the question is, what do you do when you have, you know, a society that's organized such an important institution that kind of sweeps up its most vulnerable citizens and then harms them, rather than helps them.
Well, I think that it kind of brings us back to the conversation we were having earlier about the third strike, the three strikes law. And there's another clip from Ear Hustle about Proposition 66, which was created to lessen the large sentences from some who had been sentenced as a consequence of the three strikes law. Let's listen to Curtis from San Quentin as he describes his third crime and sentence.
The crime I committed was I walked into a liquor store, I snatched two $20 bills out of the cash register, no weapon. After I got caught for stealing the $40, I pled guilty to burglary, robbery, and they gave me 50 years to life. Currently, I'm on my 23rd year. The first time I'm eligible for parole is 2044.
But on Wednesday...
When you meet inmates like that and interview them, what is it like for you to hear that this was their crime, this is their punishment?
Right. Well, I mean, of course, it's absurd and it's really hard to take in. And I have to admit, with that story, I found it so mind-blowing that I wasn't sure he was telling me the truth. And I always say we're not journalists, you know, we're storytellers. But that was the first time I actually asked to see somebody's, I can't remember what they call it, they carry paperwork that has what your crime is, because I couldn't get my mind around that could possibly be true. But it is. And it's sickening. I mean, and you know, that's, I think, one of the problems with the three strikes law. There's no discretion, right? The judge, as far as I understand it, is forced to give these crazy sentences. Yeah.
And how did people inside reconcile that? I mean, how did somebody like Curtis, how does he handle that?
Well, I think you have to learn to live with what may seem impossible, right? I mean, what can he do? He doesn't have a choice. He can decide to not go on, or he can move forward. And he's made the decision to move forward, although he struggles with that. I think you try not to give up hope. You try to find reasons to live, and you, I guess, again, hope that something's going to change. But I think you feel pretty left behind and discarded.
Right. Jody, let's talk a little bit about the Prison Project. And I guess you won a national, or the project won the National Medal of Humanities. I think I butchered that, but I think what we know we're talking about. What was that like to hear that you had won this award and that you were being recognized by President Obama?
It was really thrilling. I have to say, standing in the White House in a room with President Obama and two former students, because I went with former students, was one of the most satisfying and thrilling moments of my entire life. Also, because he was incredibly warm, and the three of us were so nervous we could barely speak. But it was incredible. And also because the award was given in recognition of our work in the realm of higher education, right? So they didn't even really mention the prison in the commendation statement, and they talked about bringing hope and opportunity through higher education. And it was tremendous. And I think it created wonderful visibility, not just for our organization, but for the field as a whole. And you know, afterwards when it went inside, you know, students were like, so if I touch you and you touch Obama, I'm kind of touching Obama, right? It was also sort of a really cool and moving glimpse for me into how much Barack Obama meant and means to our students. You know, there's just him as a person, his sort of physicality, his being. It also brought that home for me. But, you know, it was thrilling. It was tremendous.
You mentioned that you went with two former students. Let's talk a little bit about what happens to your students afterwards. Do you keep statistics about where they go, and are they continuing their education?
Yeah. So we have finally launched a longitudinal study, and we're also going to do as part of that, a kind of retrospective study so that we can track down more people. Right now, the information I have is entirely anecdotal, and it's based on who I've been able to stay, or we've been able to stay in touch with. But students are doing all sorts of things, and many of them are continuing their studies. A lot of folks are interested in social work, so there are certain kind of common themes. Violence prevention in particular, you know, counseling addicts, that sort of thing. A lot of people are really interested in advocacy. So a lot of folks, a lot of the sort of leading advocacy organizations in the Bay Area seem to increasingly be hiring former students of ours. And, you know, and then some folks are in, you know, an array of blue-collar jobs, sometimes the same work they were doing before they came in. I mean, it really runs the gamut. And I think that's the other thing that I find interesting is that what education is valuable not only because it helps people develop intellectually and, you know, the very skills you need to do different types of jobs, but also it just broadens your social network, particularly when it's face-to-face in the middle of the Bay Area. And so a lot of folks I see benefit not just from the skills and the sense of self, you know, the ways in which those things have been transformed, but also through the contacts and the relationships that they've built. And I see a lot of that sort of transmittal of social capital through all the programs that are running inside, which I find really exciting.
Yeah. It's great to hear that people are being able to have a life outside after having been in a program like this. And I think a lot with prison life for us and the general population is filled with probably misconceptions. And what are some of the biggest misconceptions about prison life and San Quentin specifically that you encounter?
Well, I think with Ear Hustle specifically, people always ask about the humor. Like, why is there so much humor in the podcast? And so I believe there must be this big misconception that everyone is angry and scary and only has one emotion. Mm. You know, like, I think that's so bizarre that people think that there wouldn't be humor and moments of delight and frustration and scary things. I mean, that's what it means to be human. So I would say that.
Yeah.
Well, there are two things that can't be taken away from you, right? One is your education and the other is your sense of humor. I mean, I think humor is just like a raise to the level of an art form inside. I mean, it's also an incredible coping mechanism, right? Yeah. To just find humor. It's it's a way of maintaining perspective and also being creative.
Yeah. I think also in Ear Hustle, I remember hearing someone say, in prison, they can't take away your fantasies, your dreams.
Your dreams, your fantasies.
Memories. Yeah,
your memories. Yeah, it's true. I think, you know, I don't know if this is a misconception, but the other thing that I really enjoy with the men inside is that most of the men that I come into contact with are amazing creative problem solvers. And in some ways, they think like artists. And being an artist is someone who can solve problems in an unusual way. And I think because so much is taken away from you in prison, you've got to figure out how to do things that are normally taken care of for you. And so that is another way of really exercising the brain and making you a really interesting person to talk about, because you're always coming at something from a very different angle than most people outside would.
Yeah.
So I love that creative problem solving.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's next for Ear Hustle.
Yes.
There was season one was last year, and I believe season two is coming out shortly.
Oh, yes.
What can we look forward to?
So March 14th, we're coming back. We're working on some kind of different stories. We're trying to get to a part of the prison that's very difficult for people to get to, and that's death row. It's very hard for journalists to get up there, so we are trying to problem solve our way to get two men up there to do a story about what is life like on death row, not about people's crimes. This season, we're also going to, for the first time, have an outside person as the main character. I don't want to say too much about it. We're working on a story about fathers and sons and what it means when you meet your son again, almost really for the first time, and you're both serving time in prison. How do you try to resolve that kind of relationship? We're doing a story about how to do different things in prison, which will be about the creative problem solving. We'll do a normal Q&A, and then hopefully something about food.
Oh, interesting. Yes. And how many episodes?
Eight. So we'll be doing two seasons a year, eight episodes. And people always ask why we can't do more. It's such hard work. I mean, for us, doing 16 in a year is going to be a pretty big undertaking.
Well, and I think an interesting and unique feature of your podcast is that the warden is recorded as part of it.
I'm sorry, I've got to correct you. It's the public information officer.
The public information
Lieutenant
officer.
Sam Robinson.
Okay, Sam Robinson.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about that. He approves the podcast?
Yes. So, as I said, he's the public information officer. He approves all of the media that comes in and goes out. And so people always ask, you know, does he censor what we do? And he would say to you that he is looking for factual, you know, things to be factual, and for us to not do stories that are going to cause harm within the prison. I don't feel particularly censored by him. He's been incredibly supportive. He talks through the stories with us. But we couldn't get away from the fact that he has to okay everything. So that's why we include him, that Lieutenant Sam Robinson, and I okay this story. And he's got a great voice. Actually, he's going to be telling a few stories this season, which I'm excited about. We had a lot of people requesting more Lieutenant Robinson. So there will be more Lieutenant Robinson.
Well, it seems like you're humanizing all aspects of the community.
You know, I would like to talk about that because it is about the entire community at San Quentin. So we hope this season also to include more correctional officers and people who actually work in the prison, because there probably are as many misconceptions about the people that work in there as there are about the people that are housed there. And it's important. I mean, they make the community work or not work, and so we want to hear their stories too. And there's interesting relationships that happen between the men inside and the correctional officers that work there.
And do you find that as well, Jody, in your program, that do correctional officers play a role? Or
No, I was actually thinking that earlier. We couldn't run our program without the support of really decent and dedicated staff, both correctional and non.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. But that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Nigel Poor, the co-host and co-producer of Ear Hustle, which is recorded at San Quentin, and Jody Lewin, who's the founder and executive director of the Prison University Project at San Quentin. Thanks to both of you for joining us. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, let us know what you thought about the program. Please visit us at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. The Tonight's Show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. We're off next week, but please join us in 2 weeks for our next episode of City Visions. Thanks.
But wishing doesn't do any good when time rolls by so fast. I traded in my youth for these prison blues. I guess it was my first mistake. Spent the love of my family.
This is 91.7 KLW San Francisco.